I'm interviewing somebody called Simon Parks, who I've never heard of before, and he's going to give me his backstory. He's, in fact, he's just taken to the stage, been on the stage, talked about his story, and it's now over to you, Simon. You're a fellow Yorkshireman.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to do the interview. It's very kind of you, and thank you to Miles as well. Yes, I've just done the hour and a half up on the stage there, during which we had some black helicopters fly overhead, and there's been some psychic attacking, and my throat is not as good as it could be. And that's not because I've been talking for an hour and a half, it's because someone has been sitting in a room trying to psychically squeeze my throat. It didn't work, I finished and completed, and I'm determined to show them by doing this interview as well.
That's funny, because I've got the problem with my throat.
Well, the people who are here to bring a news story out will be attacked in the throat.
Yeah.
Because it's to stop you talking, that's the whole point.
Yeah. So, Simon, you lived in Whitby, and what is your story? What brought you to this seminar today?
What is my story?
Yeah, what is your story?
What brought me here? Well, I was invited. It's the fourth or fifth year that Kerry Cassidy has invited me to speak at the conference. Got a lot of time for Kerry. I think she's a real warrior, a real battler.
Yeah, I interviewed her a few weeks ago.
Yeah, she's a very good person.
And it's great that we're building lots of bridges between the US and ourselves.
Absolutely. We are related. We should never forget that.
No.
Well, you know, I suppose I could, having been on the stage where many people are obviously aware of me here, maybe some of the audience don't know me, possible. My mother worked for MI5, but she was really working for the National Security Agency of America. My grandfather worked for MI6, but he was really working for the CIA.
Confused? So, you will be.
So I came up through what we call an intelligence type family. So it wasn't military, but it was intelligence. And my mother's job was to type up documents that had been brought by a guy. His code name was Paul Dunlop. That wasn't his real name, but that's the name that we called him by,
right.
Paul Dunlop. And his job was to bring documents that had come from Germany, West Germany back in those days. We're talking from about 1965 to 1979. And these were from what we call the Operation Paperclip. These were German ex-Nazi scientists who didn't want to fall into the hands of the Americans or the Russians, but stayed in Berlin and were managed by MI5, so in the Western sector. So anything that the American-German scientists couldn't work out was passed across to the Berlin group. They then did these research, whatever they were required to do, and then these documents would arrive all in German, and my mother would be given them to type them out. So the documents would have, say, secret on them, top secret, or very top secret, or what we call the purple group. These are extremely top secret. And every time Mother was working on those, in those days it was a GPO van, it wasn't British Telecom, it was a GPO van, they would sit outside 24 hours, and then my mother would have to hand the documents over. And these documents all related to alien spacecraft that had crashed, come down over the Earth. The German scientists were tasked with, some of these pages could just be 4 pages thick, some were maybe 28 to 30 pages thick, and the format was always the same. It was that we have this piece of technology, what do you think it does, what can you make it do, and give us a timescale. So these guys would try and back engineer it and then push it through to the corporations. So the one I've given in my previous talks is a nuclear reactor, which would be about the size, a cold fusion reactor, which would be the size of this table. So it's 3 foot diameter. And what the American military wanted was something that could be airlifted by helicopter to any part of a battle zone and provide immediate power. So the German scientists, we're talking now about 1971, 72, said that this couldn't happen. It would take too long to plug it in. But you could make an underground tunneling machine that was nuclear powered. And that's exactly what they did. So a lot of the things that she was working on, maybe 5, 6, 7 years later, actually came into force. So my grandfather was also a British diplomat. He was a British consul in India. He was a Freemason, although he bought himself out of that.
How did he manage to get himself out of Freemasonry?
Money. It's all about money.
Right, so he had to buy himself out.
Yes, you know, it's in the same way you buy yourself out of the army. If you have a commission in the army,
yeah,
you want to leave, it's the accepted way out. He was decorated. He had the OBE, the MBE, the CBE, and they wanted to make him a sir, knight him, but he refused because he said that having got out of their control system, he didn't want to go in anymore. So that was the family, that was the background, that's what I grew up with. I was an only child. My father had disappeared when I was about 3 months old. My mother never remarried or had another boyfriend. So it was a very close, tight relationship, and I was fully aware of what was happening.
So did your grandfather find your mum the job?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the house we lived, we were half a mile away from where she worked. She worked at a patent office called GF Redfern and Co., which was a cover for MI5. And many people that MI5 were working with were given administrative jobs in GF Redfern. And when my mother took the job working for MI5, because how they said it to her was, you know, you're a single mum, don't you think two wages would be really good? So we'll pay you and the old job will pay you. So every Friday she used to walk the half a mile to the office, sign her name and get a pay packet.
Really?
But she never worked there, but she got the pay packet, she'd come back. So she got two wages. Well, that's what they did, and that's how they do it. So she was very grateful because, you know, single parent back in the 1960s was damn difficult.
Yeah.
So that's what she did for many years, until they killed her. Basically, she became an alcoholic because of her work. She couldn't talk to anyone, or even her own father, because he wouldn't discuss it because he was ex-intelligence.
So she presumably felt lonely and...
Very lonely, very isolated. You're always looking over your shoulder. Who's following you? Is it your side? Is it the other side? Are you being eavesdropped on? What's going on? And so she took to drink. And the mistake she made was to say to them, I want to be released. Release me from the job. And you can't. You never resign. You only leave when they tell you. So she asked to be released, and then 2 weeks later she died of a heart attack. And then...
that's what they said.
Yeah, but it's medical. That's the medical report, was a heart attack. And then some, I can't remember exactly now, was it 2 months or 3 months later, I got an envelope with £2,000 pushed through the letterbox. £2,000 in 1979 was a lot of money. And a little letter with it, which said, don't look back, Dick Whittington. So I used my £2,000 and I left Brighton, which is where I lived, and went to London and got a job. So it was called blood money. They killed her, they paid me, and that's how we went.
Right, so you must be mentally scarred from this.
No, because I'm not particularly easily influenced by things. So I knew what had happened, but wasn't going to let that ruin my life or dominate my life. I've lived through years and years of skullduggery.
And what's protected you?
Well, let's first of all say perhaps I have, in the sense that I've been a very strong-willed person, always believed in the truth and upholding the right and goodness and not being corrupted. Let's talk about off-planet entities, because whilst all this was going on, I had interactions with beings that were not of this earth, and they certainly had an influence and have an influence on my life. And so I never felt lonely, never felt I was on my own, always felt there was something there to keep an eye on me. So I suppose I would be braver than perhaps most people would.
So you've had some encounters?
Yes, you could say that.
Do you want to talk about those?
I will. I'll just hit it from the back and come across, which is in 2014, I think, I can't remember exactly. The Ministry of Defence wrote to me and asked if I would like a tour of their space radar base. And I got a 3-hour tour of the Fylingdales radar space station.
Oh, right, North Yorkshire.
In North Yorkshire. And this was after I'd gone public and said that my mother worked for MI5, my grandfather worked for MI6, that I'd had a regular connection with aliens since I was about 6 months old.
How can you remember at 6 months old?
Because it's not human mind, it's your DNA soul memory. Wow. I've got a tremendous memory. I mean, even today people are like shocked. I'll say to people, I've seen you before, I saw you 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I have a photographic memory like that. So the point I want to make before I do give you some examples is that the Ministry of Defence, fully aware of who I am, what I am, yet they invited me to tour the base. And if I'd known we were having an interview, I would have shown you the commemorative coin of the 30 people. I was the only non-serving member of the military. There was a group of us. They were all military, RAF, Navy and Army. I was the only civilian there in that group. And I was the only one presented with a commemorative coin, medallion. Filing Dales had been there 50 years. The Americans had had the base there for 50 years.
Those are the golf balls?
Originally, in 1963, yes. And then in 2013, I think it was, when I went, they were the phased array radar, the pyramid. And they had made only 500 of these commemorative coins worldwide. And we were supposed to be there for an hour and a half tour. We did 3 hours. And Flight Lieutenant Wicks, who was the guy taking us around, he said, "We've got to go. We've overstayed our welcome. But before we go, those of you who are running Boy Scout clubs or Venture Scout clubs, I've got some freebies for you, and I'm not interested in that." And I was standing there, and I saw these wonderful medallions about that big, four of them, four different colours. And I said to him, "They're lovely, aren't they?" He said, "Oh, yeah," he said, "but I can't give them away to you." He said, "We've been here 50 years, and we especially had them made. The Americans made us make them, and they've made us pay for them." He said, "So even when a prime minister comes, we ask for a donation." So he said, "You can't give them to you because they have to be presented." So I said to him, "Well, can't you present one to me?" And the people behind the queue all burst into laughter at that. And he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, I don't see why not." So he said, "This isn't your property, it belongs to the United States government." He said, "You can't sell it, you can't give it away, but you can bequeath it to your next of kin as part of your will when you die. If you ever try and sell it, they will find you and you will be in prison."
Really?
And he said, "There's a number on it, mine's 548. He said, "The Americans insist that I write your name by the number so they know exactly which one you've got. So mine's 148.
I was going to say, because there's only 500.
I haven't looked at it for about 3 years. I only bring them out when I do things like this. Yes, it's sort of laser numbers etched on the side of it. On one side, it's got the filing days array, and on the other side, it's got the REF, a logo. So he said, "There, I present it to you." He said, "But you will have to give a donation." He said, "We asked for £10. So £10 gave it to him. Wow. And the two guys behind me held out their £10 because they wanted one, and he just closed the box up, said, "We have to go." So of a group of 30, I was the only one presented with that. And when we went to the gates, when we first arrived, the Ministry of Defence police, they obviously armed, they had their machine guns. And I was with somebody else who I don't have permission to admit to, but their person was with me, a member of my family. And the guy, very polite, the police officer, said, "ID, please." And this individual handed their passport to him, and he looked at the passport, looked back at this person, and then I went to give him my identity, and he just held his hand up and said, "Oh no, sir, that won't be necessary." So people have already been briefed who I was, what was happening, and I'm very, very honoured and privileged to be given the coin, and if we do another interview, I'd be very happy for you to hold it and show it up to the camera.
Okay.
So these experiences go right back to very early age. A mantis being, the Americans call them mantis, Britain we call them mantid, the Australians refer to them as manta, came to me as a very young child and said to "I am your other mummy. I am your other mummy." And then a creature which we would call reptilian, but we more correctly call a draconis reptilian, said to me, "I am your father. I am your father. From now on you will call us your mother and your father." And those interactions I've had for a very long time. Also the greys, I don't like the greys, don't get on with them very well. Also what we call the feline race or flying lions. The American military refer to them as the Kilrotti, because bless them, the American military can't pronounce it. The proper name is Kilkerry, but we call them flying lions, and they come from Orion and also from Sirius, the two dimensions and the fourth dimension. So I've had lots of interesting experiences. The beauty for me is that I've had the memory to come back. This is not coming back as a dream, it's in real time. So I have memories, and I've written much of it down, drawn much of what I can remember.
So have you written a book?
I've written one. I have not gone to publish it because I felt that that would detract from the work I wanted to do, which was I wanted to do radio shows, I wanted to interact at conferences. I felt once I wrote a book, I was putting myself down a certain road, and I didn't want to do that. When I retire, then perhaps that's what I'll do.
So you mentioned when you retire, what are you actually doing at the moment?
This is what I do. I have consultations with people come from many parts of the world. If they can afford it, they'll fly over to see me. for healing, for advice or help. If they can't afford it, then they'll do it by Skype. If they're on benefits, I'll do it for free for them. So people who are being targeted, attacked, people who have been psychically hurt, people who have escaped abuse, people who have been trapped in satanic cults, people who have mind control issues, maybe a demon possession, suicide programs, then these are the people that I will work with.
Right, okay. So the neuro-linguistic programming, common purpose, you've come across common purpose?
I have no common purpose. When I was a politician, my chief officer was trained by common purpose.
Oh, how interesting. So will you say you were a politician?
Yes.
What was your role?
I was a Labour councillor, both in Whitby and in London. I served two terms of office as a Labour councillor in Hackney.
So, Simon, you said you were a politician.
Yes.
Did you stay as a councillor? Did you move up to becoming a parliamentary candidate at all?
I was a Labour councillor in Hackney and did two terms of office. If I stayed in Hackney, I probably would have had the opportunity to do that. But for personal reasons, I left and moved to Whitby, which is quite a backwater. And I felt, having worn the T-shirt in a typical inner city area, and loved it actually, loved the people, loved helping people. But after about 5 or 6 years, the party got hold of me and said, come on, get back involved. So again, stood and was elected. Well, the great thing about all this is that I'd gone public. The public knew exactly who I was, what I was, yet they still elected me. And that goes to show that humanity is evolving.
So, you mentioned mind control, common purpose. They reckon that the top 200 civil servants in Whitehall are common purpose trained. I'm a Brexiteer. I see we're not getting Brexit. It's no surprise to me.
I disagree with you. I think we will get Brexit. I think we will.
We will, but not with this government.
Not with this Prime Minister, no.
No.
Not
the civil servants are basically, they're producing documents, the MPs are signing it. We're handing pretty much most of our military over to Brussels, but yet the military are in blissful ignorance of this, or certainly the grassroots military. I'm sure the top echelons are very aware. We've got these trade deals being signed behind closed doors, being executed within Parliament, debates are few and far
between. I voted for exit, just so you know.
Good, good. Well, it will be a long time before we get Brexit. Certainly, you know, we've had the recent announcements where things are going to be just pretty much the same as before.
You see, I don't agree with you, having been a politician, and I'll tell you why.
Why?
Because if a politician asks the people to vote and then doesn't deliver what the people vote, then the politician has no right to ask the people to ever vote again. Because why should the politician ever be trusted? Why would the people bother? So in order to overturn such a referendum, there would have to be the most enormous U-turn, which would cause consternation. I know for a fact the Labour Party is committed to Brexit. It's the Tory group that are struggling because they are caving in under the civil servants who have got a lot of side deals with them.
But remember, Jeremy Corbyn, he was always very anti the EU, but of course now he's the leader of the Labour Party. He's no longer.
No, he's anti-EU, but he's being very careful. Because if you may be aware that his largest trade union that supports him wrote to him and said, we want you to support, and he refused. He said, no, we've got to have a Brexit.
Unite.
Yes, and he actually said to them, no, we're leaving, because that's what the people want. Because when you're a socialist, what you actually believe in is if you ask the people, if you deign to ask the people what they want, and they tell you, you must do what they want, because otherwise it's pure arrogance.
So but you see, we're accepting all the EU legislation. You know, we've only just narrowly come to... Well, I don't know if you know, there was a debate in the European Parliament a few days ago, and they were trying to put internet censorship on there for Facebook. And to start charging for sharing articles.
Yes.
I mean, they just want total control of
yes.
us. As I say, you know, we have signed up to virtually everything of the permanent structured cooperation on the military side.
Yes.
And, you know, it's part of the civil servants exit deal
yes.
that we give everything away.
Yes, and it's totally wrong, because what needs to happen is we need to say anything and everything that was signed since, 1974 is null and void. Hannibal started fresh from today.
Well, that's a good point, because the thing is, the Article 50 was always going to be trapped, because the people negotiating it are people who actually want to stay in.
Of course. I mean, Tony Blair, for instance.
Yes. We want to have, a return to common law.
Yes.
We're now living in it's not democracy at all, is it?
No, not anymore.
And Parliament has been deemed to be sovereign. Well, that's never been the case. The people are sovereign. So I think we just... I quite often disregard what's going on in Parliament, you know, with the withdrawal bills and so on and so on, because to me it's just like a pantomime.
Well, it is. I mean, there's this talk about soft Brit exit and hard exit. I mean, there's no such thing. You're either in or you're out.
That's right. And they're either governors or they don't.
Exactly. And the reality is that any political party, any government that tries to renege on the vote is doomed politically. Because of that, the people will never vote for them again in a generation, because they will say to them, you betrayed us.
Well, I've got an interesting concept for you, because a few of my friends reckon that political parties in the next 5 years are actually going to become a thing of the past.
Yes, I've already planned on that, in the sense that they will be obsolete, because they are seen to be so distant, so unrelated, so unconnected to what people want. And some of my conferences, and a shame you missed this one, I didn't cover it on this one, but I ask a number of my conferences, I say I want to divide the group into two. I want you to imagine you've all got school children, and a child gets seriously injured or knocked down on a road, and you decide as a group of parents that you want a zebra crossing. How do you do it? So they all have put the audience put their head together, and I said, well, we'll get a petition together and we'll do this and we'll do that. And I said, stop you there. You have no power. The people with power pick the telephone up, phone the chief executive of the local authority and say, I want a zebra crossing here, and they'll do it because of the way it works. I said, you are disempowered, you don't understand it. And I take my audience through the system that shows how they have to take the power back, how they take their authority back. How they make politicians actually work for them and not the other way around. So the system is wrong. Political system isn't about... Put it this way. The best way is for everybody who wants to be a politician to stand before the people and say, I promise to build a new school, or I promise to build a new hospital, or I promise to increase the military spending by 25%, whatever it is. And then at the end of the 4 or 5 year term, did you do it? If you didn't, you're out. Not, I'm voting for you because of the colour, but did you actually deliver what you said you would? And if you did, you're a good man or a good woman, we'll vote you back in again. And that makes people accountable to their constituency. That's what we need.
Well, of course, at the moment, we've got the reds and the blue team, and these people are chosen by the elites. Mm-hmm. So they're put in place.
Yeah.
And quite often, they'll be yes people, and they will do as they're told. I mean, even the Brexit MPs, if there is such a thing, they're all kowtowing now to Theresa May, and they're not going to ruffle anybody's feathers. So I'm the campaigns officer for an organisation called www.democracy17-4.org. And what we're believing now is we need to remove our MPs. We need to get in independents under an umbrella of pro-Brexit, pro-the-people, you know, anti-5G, anti-globalist agenda, against the New World Order. And if we can get people like that to fill that vacuum, and then they account, it's the constituents that choose just the one candidate that fits that bill. So we don't have this vote splitting. I mean, recently we had a by-election in Lewisham East.
Yes.
14 parliamentary candidates, 13 of which were of political party affiliation, and there was one independent. So probably about 5-6 Brexit anti-globalist candidates, and they split the vote. I mean, that's perhaps a bad example, because even if you combined all the votes together of those 5 or 6 parties, what we need to do now is expose what the other parties actually represent. They don't represent the working person. We need to take back control, which is what we promised from the referendum, and we need to be working for the people. We're not supposed to be doing things to the people. We need to represent them. So maybe this is something you could have a look at. I've got a leaflet inside.
One of the issues, first and foremost, is the programming that the electorate have in terms of thinking that someone who's not a political party can't possibly win.
Yes.
So this is a subject that's been indoctrinated into people. The way a person dresses and the way they speak has an effect on the votes cast. The Conservatives used to, when they had a golden boy, they would actually kit that person out with the most expensive suits they could, because they knew that for many people, they would aspire to being like him. You must be successful. You must know what you're doing. Therefore, I'm going to vote for you because you'll make it work. So when you understand the manipulation of the mindset, then you can begin to take it apart and run a counter-program to it. And I often have done that. That's why I've been successful and been elected in areas that perhaps I might not have been other than that. Ultimately, if you can make a connection to the electorate and you bother to knock on their door and talk to them, and they can make a judgment that you're a good man or a good woman, they'll vote for you. They'll vote for you because that's a personal belief and that personal trust. That's what politicians generally don't have. They'll give you a leaflet and they'll say vote for the colour rather than the individual. And that's what's happened, because people sadly have allowed themselves to be disempowered because the system is clever. The system has money, it has the machinery, and it has the psychological capability to do that. But once the public wake up to the fact they've been manipulated, they will vote in their droves to be away from that. What, in my humble opinion, the exit campaign did was give the underdog the chance to fight back. Because if you looked at the response from people, they thought, I can't believe it. I can't believe it we've got through, because they're so used to the system, faking it, cheating, losing ballot boxes. But they did get it. And the reason they got it was because it was overwhelming. And that's the biggest thing to say to people: you can do it. You can make a change. You're not on your own. You can do it. And if you do that, then you actually empower people and you fire them up, not to do anything wrong, just to believe in themselves and to believe in their country. This was one of the most fantastic countries ever. Look at us now. Is it because the people have gone to seed? No, it's not. It's because the system is preventing people from being who they want to be. You know, and once you break that control system, people will actually go back and be entrepreneurial. You know, why don't we have a brass band in every town? Why isn't there a bandstand? Why is it wrong to play music that my grandfather could whistle quite happily? He was born in Lancashire. And, you know, because it's now seen as it's too military, or it's too nationalistic, or what have you. No one's saying kill anyone. All you're saying is let's be proud of who we are. And British people actually want to be British. And I'm not just talking about white people. There are Indians, there are Pakistanis, who actually love the British culture. So they often see more in it than our own civil servants see in it.
It's a shame, isn't it, that you have to wait for the World Cup to actually be able to unfurl the flags?
Yes, because it's almost seen as not right.
Exactly.
It's almost offensive, that.
Anyway, Simon, so we have got to make sure that people aren't brainwashed anymore,
exactly.
Which is going to be difficult. A lot of people now, a lot of friends of mine are actually doing away with their BBC licence, that they're throwing the TV out the window. They don't watch the TV anymore. And it's Brussels Broadcasting Corporation at the end of the day.
That's right.
So without that indoctrination, without the mainstream media, newspapers, you know, and going for the alternative news, watching videos like this, what is really happening out there with real people, the land grabs. I've just recently interviewed somebody whose property has been taken off them. These things are really happening to thousands and thousands of people now, through no fault of their own. So, Simon, watch this space. Look out for Democracy 17.4.
Thank you, Eva.
And thank you to the audience for watching today. I've introduced you to Simon Parks. There are lots of videos about Simon on the internet. Please do your research. See you again sometime. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Simon.
It was a pleasure.